Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, fellow liberals and Democrats, open-minded Republicans, and concerned citizens of all backgrounds. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. Welcome aboard, and let's get to work. First, a bit of sad personal news. One of my mother's brothers has passed away. My mother is from Panama. So I'm doing the show here in the country of Panama because I'm here for my uncle's funeral. Topics today will include the Detroit bankruptcy, Obamacare's lower costs, the opinions of Latinos regarding the progress of immigration reform, and the increasing global wealth disparity and what that might mean, and more. We'll also have our trademark Hall of Fame and Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If you want to write to me and give me your opinion of any topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your opinion on the air. That's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. So we'll get started right after this.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes. Florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue@scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
Welcome back. This past week, the folks in charge of the city of Detroit filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, saying that the city was $18 billion in debt and could not meet all of its obligations. The two biggest creditors or obligations are the pension programs for city employees and also city municipal bonds, some of which are secured and whose obligations cannot be relieved by bankruptcy. Now, that's the only simple part of the story regarding the Detroit bankruptcy. See, after bankruptcy was filed, we then found out that there was some chicanery with the bankruptcy filing. The folks in charge of the city, and I will talk more about who those folks are in a minute, but they were supposed to be meeting with a separate group to include representatives from the city's creditors to determine if there were ways that bankruptcy could be avoided. But instead, it turns out that the meeting was a diversion to occupy those who were against the bankruptcy while the folks in charge of the city ran to federal court to file for bankruptcy. On Friday, a county judge in Michigan approved an injunction preventing the bankruptcy filing from going forward. You see, it seems that Michigan law prevents the state and municipalities from reducing or eliminating contractually obligated benefits to state and municipal employees, which apparently is exactly what those currently in charge of Detroit intended to do with the bankruptcy filing. Also, last week came calls from a number of Michigan representatives to have the federal government bail out the city of Detroit. Now, government bailouts since 2007-2008 have become pretty unpopular on both sides of the aisle, so objections to a federal bailout of Detroit were bound to be raised, not least of which by Senator Rand Paul, who indicated that if a federal bailout of Detroit was to happen, it would happen over his dead body. No, I'm not kidding. He really said that. On Friday, I appeared on Fox News, Your World with Neil Cavuto, to discuss a potential federal bailout and had this to say.
at this point. We don't know. Steve Laser, who says Detroit deserves a bailout, and Sherry Jacobus, who disagrees with that. So, Steve, bailout. Another. We're going to say the B word on a Friday here?
We
is
are.
Is that what we're going to do, Steve? Why? Why do you think that this is that's the right thing to do right now?
You know, at first I have to say, when I thought of this, when I heard about it, I said, you know what, Detroit made its own mistakes. Let them deal with it. Let them go bankrupt. But I tell you, I thought about it in terms of the bailouts of Wall Street in 2008.
The big banks,
the
big
automakers. You know, and these are folks who failed at their core competency. And we still bailed them out, these private companies. And it actually didn't work out so badly. We actually got most of that reimbursed, and those companies are now doing fairly well. These are private sector, public sector employees who were promised a certain benefit. You know, in some sense, a deal is a deal. They didn't do anything wrong, and now we're saying, oh, you have to bear the brunt of these mistakes by the people who've run the city of Detroit when we've bailed out these folks who are making millions of dollars on Wall Street.
For getting involved in bad debts and things like that. And what Sherry's saying is that the citizens of Detroit had a responsibility here, and maybe they didn't hand up and, you know, hold up their end of the bargain.
Well, there should be consequences, and I'll tell you what the consequences should be. Let me first say what they shouldn't be. They shouldn't be the folks like the firemen who have been protecting the city of Detroit. They shouldn't be the police officers who are protecting the city of Detroit who have dealt with a city that's like one of the most dangerous cities in the country, if not the world. The consequence should be, I understand the point that it's not the fault of the rest of the folks in the country. Consequence should be, if the federal government has to come in and bail out a city like Detroit, the entire leadership of the city gets terminated.
Now, folks, I can't put it any more plainly than that. We can bail out the wealthy folks on Wall Street, but we can't honor our obligations to the police and firefighters and other City of Detroit employees who did nothing wrong. And they worked their whole lives, in some cases, protecting the city's, the lives of the city's citizens. That doesn't sit well with me. In fact, it makes me furious. If we can put $700 billion on the line in TARP to bail out the banks and other financial institutions, if we can put $60 billion on the line to bail out GM and Chrysler, then you bet that we can put $18 billion down to rescue the pensions of the city workers of Detroit and help it meet its other financial obligations. And the fact is, this is not new, right? The federal government has helped out other municipalities in the past, the city of Portland, Oregon being a good example. In 1958, the federal government helped Portland, Oregon establish the PDC, or Portland Development Commission. Now, the PDC is described on its website as Portland's Economic Development and Urban Renewal Agency. PDC is pursuing an aggressive strategy to create one of the world's most desirable and equitable cities by investing in job creation, innovation, and economic opportunity throughout Portland. PDC is an example of how the federal government can partner with a municipality to improve economic conditions and quality of neighborhoods. Now, earlier in this piece, I talked about, quote, those in charge of the city. Now, I'm sure several of you are wondering about that phrase, and if you're wondering at it, you're probably specifically wondering why I'm not talking about the mayor and city council of Detroit. That would make sense, right? Well, one of the interesting subtexts of the Detroit bankruptcy is the fact that since March 28th, Detroit has been under the control of a Governor Snyder-appointed emergency financial manager, not its local elected officials. Now, this is interesting for numerous reasons, not the least of which is that the citizens of Michigan had a referendum they voted on this last November that specifically rejected the ability of the state to do this. Now, despite the voters expressing their will about this at the voting booth, Alternate's Harriet Rowan reported in March that a month after Election Day, the Republican state legislature rammed through a new law to do the very thing that the voters of Michigan had just rejected. So since March 28th, Detroit has been under the control of an emergency financial manager by the name of Kevin Orr, and Detroit residents have not been served by the officials they elected. Again, that's despite the fact that the use of state-appointed emergency financial managers to take over municipalities has been explicitly rejected by the people of Michigan. That's bad enough, right? That the people rejected this, and the governor and the Republican state legislature of Michigan passed a new law to do it anyway. That's bad enough, right? But the effect of this, has been that less than 4 months later, after this emergency financial manager forcibly took control of the city of Detroit, this emergency financial manager filed to declare bankruptcy for the city. That's what this supposed expert who was brought in over the specific objections of Michigan and Detroit residents did. That is his, and by extension, Michigan's governors and Republican state legislatures' big solution to Detroit's financial problems. Hey, I could have done that. Anybody could have done that. Any one of us could have thrown up our hands on that situation and declared bankruptcy. That doesn't take a whole lot of skill. That doesn't take a person who was forced on the city to do. You know how I said on Fox News that those in leadership positions should be held responsible and terminated if the finances of a city imploded like this? Well, thanks to the governor and Republican state legislature in Detroit, that goes well beyond the city's elected officials. The emergency financial manager, Michigan's governor, and the entire state legislature of Michigan is now responsible, and they should all be forced to resign. They accepted responsibility for Detroit's finances when they took control of the city. Now this bankruptcy is also on them. It's unbelievable, isn't it? They took control away from the duly elected mayor and city council of Detroit so that they could throw up their hands and declare bankruptcy. The governor and the members of the state legislature of Michigan that voted for this shouldn't just be immediately thrown out of office. They should be in jail. What they did should be illegal. They should be prosecuted. But, of course, what law would be on the books that would anticipate wrongdoing like this? It's unprecedented. Now, I want to return to the idea of a federal bailout for a moment. Now, one of the other sad facts about the Detroit situation is that the federal government's actions, specifically free trade agreements and similar federal acts, have had a big negative effect on Detroit and what has historically been its primary industry, right? The auto industry. Without free trade that allows cheaper auto parts and assembly abroad and other measures that have hurt the U.S. auto industry, does anyone think that the city of Detroit would be in the position it's in now? So it's appropriate that the federal government provide assistance to Detroit, because after the last 30 to 40 years or so, the federal government caused some and perhaps many or most of the city's problems. And the fact is, it's going to take the resources of the federal government to turn the city around. The problems that the city has is massive. USA Today noted that Detroit's population has declined from 1,849,000 in 1950, at the height of the U.S. auto industry's dominance, to about 701,000 today. In 2000, Detroit had 7.3% unemployment, which was actually high for that year, but today it stands at 18.6% unemployment. There are 78,000 abandoned buildings in Detroit, which often become havens for drug addicts and gangs. Detroit has 66,000 vacant lots. Only 33% of the city's ambulances are in working order, and 40% of its streetlights are not working. We can go on. The city, in almost every way imaginable and measurable, is in bad shape. So Detroit's got a lot of problems. It's going to take a lot of efforts and resources to fix those problems. But taking that all out on city workers and their pensions, it's not the solution. Moving on. The U.S. sees less than expected Obamacare insurance costs. From the moment that the president started talking about health care reform and the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, back in June of 2009, yes, it's been that long, the Republicans have been saying that it wouldn't work, that it would be a disaster, that it would increase costs, it would increase wait times to see a doctor, all of those things, and that doesn't take into account the more insane things that they said, like calling it socialism and all that other crazy nonsense. But more recently, Republicans have been claiming that the final provisions couldn't be implemented, and they were cheering on the administration's recent decision to delay implementation of the requirement for small businesses to offer insurance to their employees. That's only one side of the story, though. On the other side, there have been a lot of successes to talk about and a lot of people who have been able to get health insurance who otherwise would not have been able to do so, with life-saving results in some cases. A Thursday, July 18th Reuters article confirms another significant success story regarding a provision of the Affordable Care Act that many of us, me included, have been talking about in terms of a provision that would make a big difference in terms of the costs and value of health care in this country. I'm going to get back to that in a second. Reuters also reported on the 18th that the administration forecasted sharply lower than expected insurance costs for consumers and small businesses in the new online state health care exchanges. The new exchanges are slated to begin enrolling as many as 7 million uninsured Americans for 2014 on October 1st in federally subsidized health care plans ranging in quality from platinum with the highest premiums to bronze with the lowest. A report by the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, said the data from 10 states and the District of Columbia shows preliminary 2014 premiums on the lowest cost mid-range silver plans in those marketplaces to be 18% lower on average than earlier administration and congressional estimates. Now, mind you, those earlier administration and congressional estimates were claimed to be too low by Republicans. Republicans said the costs were going to be significantly higher. It turns out the opposite is true. The costs are going to be significantly lower. Rates for businesses with fewer than 50 employees that purchase small group coverage through exchanges could also be 18% lower than what those same plans would cost without President Barack Obama's landmark health care reform law, based on data from six states, said HHS. Now, the report was released in conjunction with a speech by President Obama on how health care reform is already benefiting consumers. It represents the administration's latest bid to counter Republican allegations that consumers and businesses will see sharply higher costs from the exchanges than individuals are currently paying on the market. Now, this is all in addition to the provision of Obamacare that requires that health insurance companies spend a minimum of 80% per year of the premiums that are paid to them on actual health care. Imagine that, right? If the end of the year comes and they've spent less than that, they've got to refund that portion of the premium to policyholders. So as someone who has been giving talks on these programs and as someone who has been debating these programs with Republicans on TV and radio, this is the point where I just stand back, smile, and let the statistics do the talking. No, we're not killing grandma. We're not seeing a government takeover of health care. None of those lies that have been told by Republicans is coming to pass. And on behalf of those of us who said that the Affordable Care Act would be a good thing, let me just say, we told you so. Next up, think you know how bad economic equality is in the U.S. and around the globe? I know I did. I think most of us know that in the U.S. and in the world, we have issues with wealth inequality and income inequality that has grown out of control. But I was shocked by an article in BuzzFlash by editor Mark Carlin, which noted that, get this, the richest 300 people on Earth have more wealth than the poorest 3 billion combined. Now, I don't shock easily, but that fact shocked me. When I got over the shock, I immediately thought of an internal memo that was written a few years ago by Citibank's then global strategist, A.J. Kapoor, that talked about how we were living in a plutonomy and that Citibank and those whom it advises needs to conduct business based on that fact. A plutonomy is simply an economy where the wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few. Ever since that internal memo was leaked to the public, I've been thinking about what that means for the economies and businesses around the world. Let's start simply. There are two kinds of businesses in general. There's these so-called B2B businesses, or firms that make products and services that are bought primarily by other businesses. And there are B2C firms, where the businesses offer goods and services primarily to individual consumers. Now, if you were going to start a B2C business, business-to-consumer business, and you could start any kind of business that you wanted to start, would you start a business whose customers were the average person or the wealthy? Now, based on these stats that we're seeing, in general, it doesn't make sense to start a business that offers goods and services to the average person if the wealth and disposable income is concentrated in the hands of the wealthy, does it? No. If you're going to start a B2C business, it makes sense if you can start one whose goods and services appeal to the wealthy. Not only that, you need to find out where the wealthy live and start that business there. Now, so far, I don't think this is how most people in the world are thinking about business startups, but it makes sense, doesn't it? I see a future where most B2C firms exist to provide goods and services to the wealthy. In the poorest areas of the world, it's no doubt already like that, but it's becoming more and more like that everywhere else as well, and that trend will only continue. But think about it. What kind of a world would that be, where economic activity is so decidedly centered on a small percentage of wealthy people, and where the rest of the world essentially exists to serve them and has little to no disposable income? If there are no big changes, I think we're going to find out what that's like, and sooner than most of us realize. The trend in the U.S. and the world is one where more and more wealth is put into the hands of fewer and fewer people. The world has about 7 billion people. So if the wealthiest 300 have more wealth than the bottom 3 billion people, it means the wealthiest 300 people have more wealth than nearly 43% of the world's population. That's just staggering. Similar to the picture globally, the most wealthy 400 people in the U.S. have as much wealth as the bottom 50% of Americans. There are 319 million Americans, so that means that the 400 wealthiest Americans have as much wealth as the poorest 160 million Americans. This has all kinds of implications, all kinds of ways that you can look at this and think about what this means. One of them is, in an effort to appear to help its employees budget and survive on their meager earnings, Gothamists reports that McDonald's here in the U.S., which often pays minimum wage to employees, and I'll talk about the U.S. minimum wage in a moment, but McDonald's partnered with Visa to put together sample budgets for its workers in an effort to help them out, right? That's fine so far, right? Those budgets made their way onto the Internet. The result has been a public relations disaster for McDonald's, and it's really showed what being a minimum wage earner means for somebody in the United States. While intending to show that one can survive on a minimum wage, it showed actually the exact opposite. The first thing that McDonald's did was include a line item in the budget for a second job. And they included nearly $1,000 a month for that second job, which is close to the take-home pay for the full-time McDonald's job. Then the McDonald's budget calls for rent of $600 a month, car payment of $150 a month, $0 for heating per month, and other fun figures. Now, where in the United States, can you get an apartment for $600 a month? Not too many places. You have to go to some of the poorest counties in the country to get a one-bedroom apartment for $600 a month. Again, that budget that allows $600 to be spent per month on an apartment requires a second job making almost as much as you make at McDonald's. So the actual amount available for rent if you're only working at McDonald's is around $300 a month. And that would include no money for heat in the winter at the same time. Matter of fact, the budget with a second job includes no money for heat in the winter. Now, I did some research. There is nowhere in the country where you can get a $300 a month one-bedroom apartment. The cheapest one-bedroom apartments in the United States are in Puerto Rico, and even those, the lowest amount that you can get one for in the poorest neighborhoods of Puerto Rico is $368 a month. Now, as I said, McDonald's is one of the places in the U.S. that pays minimum wage. In the United States, the wages of lower-income people have fallen to the point where they can no longer make ends meet on a minimum wage salary. If the minimum wage that existed in the 1960s had kept up with inflation, the federal minimum wage in the U.S. would be about $10.52 per hour. Instead, it's about $7.25 an hour. Back when Barack Obama was discussing increases to the U.S. minimum wage back in March, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren noted that if the U.S. minimum wage had kept up with increases in worker productivity as well as inflation, the U.S. minimum wage would now be, get this, $21.72 an hour. To get that figure, Senator Warren cited a 2012 study on the minimum wage for the Center for Economic Policy Research, which combines inflation with increases in productivity to get benchmarks that would explain what the minimum wage should be. So if you want to know in the U.S. why the rich are getting richer, the rich are pocketing the difference in productivity and inflation that workers are generating relative to the late 1960s. For just minimum wage workers, the wealthy and owners of companies are pocketing an extra $14.47 per hour over what they were seeing as profit per worker in 1968. That's why the wealthier are getting so rich and why the poor are getting so poor. That is the real transfer of wealth going on in America. Republicans like to attack President Obama for wanting to fix this problem. They label him as the guy who is transferring wealth from the wealthy to the poor. They're calling that socialism. Well, Republicans are about 45 years late to the party. Wealth has been in the process of being transferred from regular workers to the wealthy since the 1960s. That's why we have such problems with wealth disparity between the top 1% and top 10th of 1% versus the rest of the country here in the U.S. That's the other side of this income and wealth inequality, where you see the top 300 people in the world having more money than the poorest 3 billion, or the top 400 wealthiest people in the U.S. having more than the poorest 160 million Americans. And there, besides the morality questions that brings up, and those are pretty substantial, there are economic and business questions, like ones that I've pointed out earlier in this segment, that we really have to consider. What does that mean for clothing manufacturers when so few people are going to have disposable income to buy clothes? What does that mean for car manufacturers? So this is an issue that we have to wrestle with and decide. Just from a practical matter, forget the morality of the poor not having a lot of money and the rich having way too much. Just from a practical standpoint, if this is the way we're going to go and we're not going to change it, we have to change how we structure business in this country. We have to change and advise people on what kind of businesses to open. We've all got to start serving the wealthy, essentially. Now, obviously, I don't recommend that, but obviously we've got to take into account what is happening with wealth, or we've got to fix it. Those are the two choices. Right now, we're not doing either one. Something has to be done to counter the transfer of wealth from the majority of people to these small number of uber wealthy people. We'll be right back. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. LatinoDecisions.com reports new polling results released this past Thursday that show clear evidence that Latino voters now believe that the Republican anti-immigrant voices in the House are not isolated individuals, but that many Republicans in Congress hold these views. Latinos were asked about statements from congressional Republicans that compared undocumented immigrants to livestock, compared them coming to the U.S. with the Holocaust, and 6 other statements made by sitting Republicans in the Congress. Latinos who are American citizens were asked their opinions of Republicans based on those statements. The results were pretty conclusive. The 8 statements and beliefs were judged by 66% of Latinos responding to the poll as being held by a majority of Republicans in Congress. And about 70% of Latinos said that the 8 quotes made them feel less favorable to the Republican Party in general. Finally, 67% of Latinos responded said that they did not think Republicans respect the Latino community. I think that says it all. We'll be right back.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
Blinded by the light. Wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light.
And now it's time for our weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. Winning the Hall of Fame this week for making great sense is President Barack Obama. The president unexpectedly on Friday weighed in on the Trayvon Martin verdict with a poignant speech about what it's like to be a young black man in America. Let's listen to a few parts of that speech.
You know, when Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here. I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that that doesn't go away. You know, there are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. And for those who resist that idea that we should think about something like these Stand Your Ground laws, I just ask people to consider, if Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? And do we actually think that he would have been justified in shooting Mr. Zimmerman, who had followed him in a car, because he felt threatened? And if the answer to that question is at least ambiguous, then it seems to me that we might want to examine those kinds of laws.
Now, I'm a mixed-race person. If you've seen pictures of me, I think that's pretty clear. Like the president discussed, I've been followed around in department stores, and I've had the experience as a teen of women clutching their purses in elevators when I walk in, thinking that because of my appearance, because of my race, ethnicity, I was a potential threat to rob them. So I know what the president is talking about here. And I think an answer to the question posed by the president, could Trayvon Martin have stood his ground, is obvious. If you believe everything that the defense asserted in this case, you still have a kid walking through a neighborhood in which he belonged, since his father was living there. He was minding his own business until approached by someone who approached him because of his ethnic appearance. If Trayvon felt threatened by Zimmerman when Zimmerman did that, he should have been able to stand his ground and fight and potentially use deadly force. Instead, the person who took it upon himself to decide that Trayvon could be a threat, the person who initiated some kind of discussion or contact, was treated as if he had the right to use deadly force. It's impossible to conceive of a situation where a black man would have been afforded the same ability and rights, particularly versus a white person. I watched the reaction to the president's speech on the internet and on my Facebook page, and I'm saddened by how many people just don't get it. It's ironic and counterintuitive, but the fact that so many people don't get it proves how necessary it was for the president to make that speech. We still have a long way to go, and America needs to continue to work to do better on racial issues. So congratulations to President Obama for taking a big risk, explaining what needed to be explained, and he wins the Hall of Fame this week for making great sense. Now we have our Hall of Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made shameful nonsense.
All aboard!
In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have rocker and somehow popular conservative personality, Ted Nugent. Now, I'm going to get to what Nugent said this week that allowed him to make the Hall of Shame, but I think it's first important to understand who this guy is. Now, some of these fun facts that I'm going to mention come from a SheKnows.com article by Megan Morris. But you have to consider and wonder why someone like Ted Nugent is being given any voice at all in politics. This is a guy who, as a 30-year-old adult, adopted a 17-year-old Hawaiian girl from her parents so he could have sex with her without being charged with statutory rape. NME magazine records this as one of the 21 grossest moments in rock. Imagine that. Imagine, with all of the competition in rock, what it takes to make it on the list of the 21 grossest moments in rock. He did it. This is a guy who likes to claim he's some sort of great American patriot, but when it came down to putting his money where his mouth was, he dodged the Vietnam draft. Do you know how badly Nugent wanted to avoid the draft? He avoided it by showing up in front of the draft board and defecating in his pants. That's the uber patriot Ted Nugent, who is a conservative icon today. On feminists, Nugent has been quoted as saying, "What's a feminist anyways? A fat pig who doesn't get it often enough." As creepy as that is, it's probably to be expected from a guy who at 30 adopts a 17-year-old girl so he can have sex with her, right? So, you know, there's that. Nugent was one of those folks who went to South Africa to perform while it was still an apartheid state, despite a boycott by most other performers. At the time, Nugent said, quote, "My being there isn't going to affect any political structure. Besides, apartheid isn't that cut and dry. All men are not created equal." Yes, he said that. This self-described American patriot said all men are not created equal. Does Nugent not understand anything about the philosophies that were the basis for creating this country in the first place? He claims he's a patriot. He claims he's all about America and the things that are, you know, what America is about, but clearly doesn't get it. Now, that's only one of many examples of Nugent's opinion of people of other races and nationalities. For instance, when asked about his fan base in Japan, Nugent replied, quote, "Yeah, they love me. They're still A blanks," where A blanks is a word that ends in holes. "These people, they don't know what life is. I don't have a following. They need me. They don't like me. They need me. Foreigners are A blanks." There's that word again that ends in holes. "Foreigners are scum. I don't like them. I don't want them in this country. I don't want them selling me donuts. I don't want them pumping my gas. I don't want them downwind of my life, okay? So anyhow, and I'm dead serious," end quote. What a guy. On African Americans and slurs directed at them, Nugent said, quote, I use the N-word a lot because I hang out with a lot of N-words, and they use the word N-word, and I tend to use words that communicate, whatever that means. But he said it. So that's who this guy is. Again, I have no idea why anyone listens to him, and I think it says something about conservatives and Republicans today that he has a pretty serious following among them. This week, Nugent makes the Hall of Shame for weighing in on the Trayvon Martin issue on Alex Jones' show by saying this.
That there are black mobs across America that are guilty of the worst racism since the Klan would hang innocent blacks. That the number one cause of a black man dying in America is at the hands of another black man. That the worst racism against blacks is documented and undeniable by blacks. That the blacks have bought into this lie that somehow they're oppressed when the president is black, the attorney general is black, governors are black, senators are black, congressmen are black, mayors are black, Oprah Winfrey, the richest people in the world are black. It is a dirty lie. And if we've got to pray for black America and beg our fellow Americans who are black to admit to this suicidal, self-inflicted curse that you've bought into the...
So the guy who uses the N-word and who went to South Africa during apartheid in defiance of a boycott and all of the ugly, ethnocentric, and creepy things this guy has said and done wants to lecture African Americans about racism. Yeah, I'm sure African Americans will give all the consideration to your words that they deserve, Ted. Ted Nugent wins third place this week in our Hall of Shame for worst nonsense of the week. In second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have Rush Limbaugh. If I was in the leadership of Premier Radio Network, the network that syndicates Rush's show, I think I'd be completely fed up with Limbaugh's antics. Here Premier is paying Limbaugh $50 million per year for his show, and Limbaugh continues to exhibit the same behavior that has resulted in problems getting advertisers to want to advertise on his show. Things are so bad for Limbaugh that many commercial breaks on his show are filled by free public service announcements instead of commercials. Meanwhile, the salespeople of Premier Networks are fighting a superhuman battle to try to keep ads and ad dollars flowing into the show. I covered that last week and on several other occasions, but last week I talked about how Premier ad salespeople are scouring the country looking for local businesses willing to take a chance and put ads on Rush's show, despite the risk that tying someone's brand to Rush might pose to their business. And that's a serious risk. Rush's use of the word slut to describe Sandra Fluke for the sin of wanting her health insurance to cover birth control pills has angered a large percentage of this country's women, understandably so, and gave rise to a movement to target Rush's advertisers and let them know that he often uses anti-women and anti-minority slurs on his show. So what does Rush do? Let's listen to a piece Rush did this past week on women and income.
Female women who marry poorer spouses make more money over time, while those women who have high-earning husbands actually take home less. This new research, economists who tracked University of Chicago MBA graduates for more than a decade discovered that the choice of a partner is an important factor in a woman's earning power. So what does that mean? It means no matter what you do, a man is still determining how the little lady gets paid. Well, what other conclusion can you come to?
What's the purpose of that piece? Rush hates working women so much that he put in the effort to put together an analysis that says to women, no matter what you do, no matter how hard you work or what things you learn, your ability to accomplish things and earn money is tied to the man in your life. Now, obviously, I don't think that's true. And you have to really twist around the stats to come to that sort of conclusion, but that's what Rush decided to do on his show. Because he didn't anger women enough by suggesting that women who want to have birth control pills covered by insurance are sluts, and if they want that, that they should be forced to have sex on camera for his enjoyment. Yes, he really said that. Now, Rush isn't happy with the nastiness he's already thrown in the direction of women in the Sandra Fluke incident. He has to throw this at them just to remind them how much he really hates women. And he laughed through the whole thing. You heard it. He laughed. He loved sticking his finger into the eye of women with that piece. It must be something to be married to this guy. Now let's listen to a piece by Rush this last week on race.
CNN informs us via Rachel Gentel that Trayvon called Rachel and said that he was being followed by a creepy-ass cracker. Piers Morgan, the ever-penetrating inquisitor, said, "So was there anything you wished you'd said when you were in there," meaning as a witness on the stand?
"Nigga."
"Why?"
"People, the whole word say it's a racist word. Mind you, around 2000, that was not, they changed it around, I think. It starts spelling N-I-G-G-A. Nigga."
What does that mean to you, that way of spelling it? What does that word mean to you?
"That means a male."
"A black male?"
"No, any kind of male."
"Black or white?"
"Black, any kind. Chinese can say nigga. That's my Chino nigga. They could say that."
So, nigga with an A on the end. Well, I think I can now. Isn't that the point? Because it's not racist. That's the point. I could be talking about a male. I could be a Chinese male. The guy at the laundromat. I could be talking about a man. That's what she said it means.
Well, that's lovely, isn't it? You can tell that Rush has been waiting his entire life for a chance to use and get away with using the N-word on the air. He used it with such glee there. Yeah, the most listened to show on the radio. 20 million people potentially listen to each show. You can talk about anything in politics that you want. You can afford the best researchers and writers to help you put material together. But with all of that, what Rush chooses to deliver to his audience is his joyful use of the N-word. So Rush has continued his really ugly statements on women and on race, and that's really bad. But on the business side of things, he's slapping the faces of folks in the syndication company that syndicates his show, who are desperately trying to keep his show afloat. Like I said at the beginning of this piece, if I was in the leadership of Premier Radio Networks, this would be the last straw. This would be it. I would have had it with Rush. I would wonder how much longer, quite frankly, I wonder that how much they're going to put up with this nonsense. Mr. Dan Metter, Premier Radio Senior Vice President and Director of Talk Radio Sales at that network, how much longer are you going to deal with this? This has to be getting old, doesn't it? You and your excellent sales staff, and I'll tell you, to be able to keep up with the amount of advertisers that are dropping his show, your sales folks have to be some of the best on the planet. They say good salespeople can sell anything to anyone. I think you have to put your sales staff up in that category. But for them and for you to go to the mat for this guy to save his show, and he keeps doing the same things that caused the problems in the first place, you know, you have to have the patience of, I don't know who, biblical patience, biblical levels of patience. Now, I don't know when you guys are going to cut Rush loose, but the time can't be that far from now, and nobody could possibly blame you when that happens. Rush Limbaugh, the most enthusiastically gender and race-biased person in media, is runner-up this week in our Hall of Shame for infamous nonsense. The award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to Virginia Republican gubernatorial candidate and current Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli. I said it before in cases like this. If you've beaten Rush Limbaugh in my Hall of Shame, you've got to have done or said something epically bad, and Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli definitely fits the bill here. As Think Progress reports, Virginia Attorney General Cuccinelli, who, surprise, surprise, is a Republican, launched a new campaign website Wednesday highlighting his efforts to reinstate Virginia's unconstitutional crimes against nature law. The rule, which makes felons out of even consenting married couples who engage in oral or anal sex in the privacy of their own homes, was struck down by federal courts after Cuccinelli blocked efforts to bring it in line with the Supreme Court's 2003 Lawrence v. Texas ruling. The law states, if any person carnally knows in any manner any brute animal, or carnally knows any male or female person by the anus, or by or with the mouth, or voluntarily submits to such carnal knowledge, he or she shall be guilty of a Class 6 felony. Cuccinelli claims that the law is only applied to sodomy committed against minors, against non-consenting adults, or in public, but fails to mention that what he wants to keep on the books criminalizes the private behavior of consenting grown-ups. So as unbelievable as it sounds, the guy who is the Republican nominee for governor of Virginia is running on a platform that criminalizes all sex in his state other than sex where a man penetrates a woman's vagina with his penis. All oral and anal sex will be illegal in Virginia if Ken Cuccinelli gets his way, regardless of if the people having the oral and anal sex are married, not married, heterosexual, homosexual, you name it. I have to check my watch and my calendar. Is it still 2013? Did someone time warp me back to England in 1820? Is Victoria Queen and head of state? Those of you who listened to my show last week, do you remember my Egypt segment when I talked about how I think that religion has no place in government and how all folks who seek to inject religion in government will eventually use their beliefs to try to restrict freedom for other people? Well, here we go again. Republicans like to bring up the boogeyman of Sharia law and claim there's a danger of Sharia being enacted here in the U.S., but Republicans, I got news for you. The folks Americans have to fear of enacting freedom-restricting laws based on religion in this country are you in the Republican Party. You are the ones who want to restrict a woman's right to choose based on religion. You are the ones who want to keep gays and lesbians from marrying and having other rights based on your religion. And you are the ones who want to have politicians like Ken Cuccinelli, who literally want to police the bedroom to make sure people are only having the kind of sex your religion thinks is okay. I wonder what percentage of people in Virginia have oral or anal sex in a year. It's got to be a high percentage. Cuccinelli wants to make a large percentage of the people of his state guilty of committing a felony. Can you imagine the potential for witch hunts there? Mike goes down to the police station and reports that he heard Pat and Chris discussing having oral sex on a regular basis. So will that police station be able to get a warrant to install a hidden camera in Pat and Chris's bedroom to film their sexual activities? This law and discussions of any attempt to enforce it seem crazier the longer one discusses it. Virginia's Republican Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, the Republican nominee for governor of Virginia, beats Rush Limbaugh and easily wins this week's award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, July 28th, and Monday, July 29th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me and the show on Twitter at Steven Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.